a very warm welcome to Sunday Brunch, live here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in today's programme... Where politics and music meet, the composer Keith Burstein joins me in the studio to talk opera and the Occupy movement. Also coming up, how to cart a masterpiece around the world. We profile the art shipping experts Gander and White. Plus...
Every personality of a cat is different. So I know that, for example, some breeders will say this particular cat is just bred to be an indoor cat. But to me, there's no such thing as an indoor cat. It's very much about their personalities.
Where cats and books cross over, plus why there shouldn't be a thing such as a female chef. And we look through the weekend papers too. All that to come this hour live from London with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. And to begin today's show, music and politics have for centuries been regular bedfellows. And my first guest is a champion of placing global issues within an operatic setting. In 2004, Keith Burstein tackled the war on terror with his opera Manifest Destiny. His latest work looks at the Occupy movement of 2012. Well, I'm delighted to say that Keith joins me in the studio on Monocle 24 to talk about his work. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Nice to see you this grim Sunday morning.
Well, actually, it's quite great to have a bit of rain, isn't it?
There's a refreshing arrival of rain. Not refreshing if, like me, you forgot to take your umbrella. But welcome to the studio. You have been a sort of a figure bubbling along in the music scene for a long time now. You're almost establishment. Tell us a little bit about your music and how you first got involved in it.
Well, I caused a bit of a wave when I decided that the most subversive thing a composer could do now was to write a melody. And if that sounds like an astonishing statement to your listeners, just think about when Arnold Schoenberg started writing in atonality, which means to say, you know, all using all 12 notes in a very highly chromatic way.
So not necessarily in the right order. It's a bit more common wise. All the right notes, but not in the right order.
So that was 100 years ago. In fact, well over 100 years ago. And I had started off in that musical culture, and I reached a point where I decided that historically, taking a wide view, that this must be, in some sense, over. And when I started to write my own music, completely without reference to that, actually, just intuitively, my work came out sounding more like Rachmaninoff and Puccini. But I didn't feel embarrassed by it, nor did I in the least bit feel that I was being plagiarist.
That's an interesting thing you can say, because, you know, if you listen to Rachmaninoff, his piano concerto is, you know, his second piano concerto is something that's inside of us all. Puccini was the great, the great popular opera writer. And they were both incredibly famous and incredibly popular in their time and are now, simply because they knew how to write a good tune. Why don't we like a good tune in classical music anymore?
We do, but who doesn't is a self-appointed clique of people who are not really composers but are administrators and sort of culture czars. You know, and those people have to be finally challenged and just say, look, Beethoven said right from the heart to the heart. So there's no intervening apparat, you know, that is saying, now, this is how you should perceive this, and I'll explain to you how this works. No, music actually is the ultimate generous art form that just goes straight intravenously into your nervous system, and does that more effectively than any other art form. So to imprison it in an ivory tower of atonalism is positively criminal after a certain point.
Yeah, I think it was someone very clever said that music is the only art form that chases you down the street. It does if you listen to a busker.
Brilliant.
I mean, we're talking about classical music, and a lot of people are still finding that barrier, which joyfully is now being broken down.
The social barrier.
The social barrier, yeah. Or, you know, 10, 20 years ago, or at least as 5 years ago, arguably, if you wanted to listen to classical music, you had to be arguably part of a certain class, certain income, certain kind of education. But nowadays, as we mentioned just before you came into the studio, you can be sitting in a fast food restaurant and a string quartet is playing on the stereo, arguably apparently to calm people down. But there's that fact is that those 12 magical notes, no matter what art form they come in, are now accessible to absolutely everybody. What effect do you think that will have on your kind of work? The fact that if someone has just heard you now, and we can all go off at the end of this programme and Google you and listen to you on iTunes, and suddenly find that actually your music can be listened to by millions now and enjoyed privately.
Yeah, I mean, there's no barrier. You know, I know from experience, because I know a huge range of people, you know, from top to bottom of this society, that if you write in tonality, which is simply to say the underlying structure of all music all over the world, it's not a human construct. If you write in tonality, you can reach any human being on the planet. And that's not a power which you should just sort of dismiss or ignore. You know, it's the most miraculous thing in the world.
And you take that, and have done recently, to examine politics through music. Well, why is it that you decided to bring the two together?
One of the things that you can do if you return to tonality is exactly address those issues which are of huge importance to everyone. So in the Prometheus Revolution, the opera which is coming on next, on the 7th of August, I decided to imagine the moment at which everybody realises that it's to the greater common good that we move beyond war, and that we move beyond greed. And I was inspired by the Occupy movement because they had this kind of meme of, you know, there's the 1% of the 1%, and then there's the 99%. And suddenly people in four-bedroom houses were identifying themselves with, quotes, the poor. And then there was this huge gap to the super rich. So I've imagined a moment in which a collective realization of that means that a group of people in the Prometheus peace movement, the imaginary peace movement, decide, including a billionaire and formerly homeless people, the motley crew, that the moment has come when a critical mass has been reached, and this awareness of the common good, a bit like Joe Cox said, you know, that when we realise that the greater number have more in common than that divides us, you know, it sounds like a throwaway line, but it's so subversive, it's so revolutionary. And these are, we're living in revolutionary times. You know, if you think about Trump, Brexit, Corbyn, this is literally a revolution that we're already in. So the word revolution has been rehabilitated.
And you pull this into a story, a musical story. Tell us a little bit about the narrative. You say that the moment that everybody realises the great gap, social and economic gap, but how do you then explain it through a story that we will all hopefully remember as well as the tunes?
Well, to help me tell the story, I've used an ancient Greek myth, the myth of Prometheus, who took the fire from the gods to give it to the mortals. And it struck me that was a good metaphor for what Occupy were saying. You know, and so the twist in the story is that the Promethean figure is not a sort of rebellious poor, but it is a billionaire who is pulled back to his roots by the fact that society is a meltdown, the sort of meltdown that we saw in 2008, the Great Crash. If you imagine that with Brexit, with everything all happening at once, multiplied by 10, that's the scenario in the opera. The Prime Minister and his wife take poison, the army is about to move in, and the Prometheus peace movement, to which Peter the billionaire returns, is left holding the balance. But the twist in the Promethean legend, and think of Julian Assange, someone like that, is that in the legend of Prometheus, he takes the fire of the gods, he gives it to the mortals, but is then horribly punished.
Why do you think that opera works so well as a political statement? I mean, it has been done for centuries, and the way that people now stage opera can make enormous political statements as well, and people get into huge amounts of trouble for it. Shostakovich's Lady Macbeth of Mstensk had him in huge amounts of trouble, and he never composed another opera because of one scene involving some corrupt police officers. It can devastate a composer's life, but at the same way, opera seems to have a way of connecting with people. What is it? Because it's often a space where there's extreme emotion. People kill each other, fall in love, die with regularity in operatic stage. I mean, it's a place of high drama. Why do you think that works so well with politics?
Well, it's a form of theatre, remember. And theatre has always been at the cutting edge of change in society. It's always been a vehicle of revolution. And I think it's, you can import, you know, I mean, the reason I chose this sort of high art form of opera to embody this idea was because, precisely because it is considered to be this kind of domain of the influential, the affluent, the powerful, you know, and so you can subversively, like a Trojan horse, you can kind of import this volatile, subversive message and kind of almost without it being realised, you've sown a seed in the domain of the very people who are going to be most challenged by this proposition that would invert the whole value system of our society. Imagine an end to war. You know, imagine everybody suddenly being equally dignified and empowered and respected, so that the full potential of the creativity of the human race could emerge, which has never happened before in the whole of history.
So that said, who is your audience? Are you appealing to the conventional operatic audience, who you know suspect are probably rather well heeled, have the time and the energy and the intellectual inclination to go to an opera, or is there a space for everybody to love it?
I think there has to be, and in this particular opera, I've very consciously experimented with actually playing with various idioms of popular theatre. So you will hear echoes of Andrew Lloyd Webber. You'll hear echoes of pop ballads. You'll hear echoes of vaudeville and Broadway musical style and Leonard Bernstein. You know, it's the possibility now is, because we live in this incredibly pluralistic, eclectic society, as you were saying earlier, it's all available. For the first time in history, anyone can just tap a button and there it is. And that has to begin to affect the imaginative processes of an artist. You know, so whereas occasionally people say, isn't your work plagiaristic? I say, well, no, you know, composers are like magpies. They take from here, there, everywhere. And because we're all so aware of this huge, diverse range of music, I've begun to actually use that as my musical language. You know, and this, of course, means that those barriers we were talking about can begin to just completely melt.
So anybody who listens to anything can love a little bit of music. It's only 12 notes. Let's have a listen a little bit to your music. This isn't from your opera. This is from something you composed a little while ago called Songs of Love and Solitude. This is number one. It's called Longing. Of Love and Longing, composed by my guest this morning on Sunday Brunch, Keith Bernstein. Keith, explain a little bit more about Songs of Love and Longing. It has a desperately gentle, wistful, romantic quality to it, but it's desperately sad.
Okay, well, the whole cycle is quite varied, but this was music that I was supported to write by extremely legendary figure of Vladimir Ashkenazi, who has become one of my mentors and sent me to Lithuania to record this, which is also where my family on my father's side came from. They were Russian Jews. And so that and my symphony Elixir were recorded in Lithuania and then released on Naxos Records, all thanks to Mr. Ashkenazi.
And what was it that inspired you to write such music?
I think when I began writing that many years ago, I was very powerfully motivated by the things that we were talking about earlier, by the idea of pure melody, you know, and spinning this unadulterated romantic melody and beautiful harmonies, and to just dare to do that, you know, because the fact is, and many of your listeners may not be aware of this, that it was true when I began my career, and I do maintain it is still to a great extent true, that it is very difficult to be taken seriously as an art composer if you write music of that ilk. You know, there's still this sense of, well, that would be very nice if it was film music. You know, and one of my teachers actually said that. Would you consider becoming a film composer? You know?
Which is amazing. Well, given so many composers actually ended up being film composers, but were brilliant composers in their own right. But when you look now at the fact that the great composers at the moment of today are mainly considered to be the cinematic composers, and you have an enormous amount of interest nowadays in, would you believe it, video gaming classical music,
yes,
which is all brilliant,
yes,
music,
brilliant,
as it goes,
yeah,
along.
Yeah.
Do you think that these people in their ivory towers are really, really missing the boat? Because nowadays film music is as valid an art form as, you know, as Mozart and Beethoven.
It's really sort of carried the flame, you know, while we went through this period of ivory tower atonal experiment, which I think was absolutely valid in its day, and I was involved with it, and I did a lot of it. But you know, as you point out, where music has to work for, you know, the kind of commercial imperatives, for instance, behind film, it must work. There, the romantic idioms and the tonal idioms simply survived because they had to. Now, what I'm doing is I'm taking my experience of the great film music and I'm reprocessing it into concert music. So I'm now kind of processing it in the opposite direction. You know, those people, many of them came from Eastern Europe, many of them were of sort of Russian Jewish origin, like Bernard Herrmann, people that went to Hollywood. They couldn't get work in the concert hall because their music was of that ilk. So they went into film, and now I'm sort of reprocessing that mass media music idiom into the art music domain.
Keith Burstein, thank you very much. Keith Burstein, I should say. Thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24. Keith's opera, The Prometheus Revolution, runs at the Grimbourne Theatre from the 7th of August here in London. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Up next, we hear from one of London's oldest art shippers. Stay with us.
The pendulum is a-swinging, and these days it's the city of Paris that's turning heads with retail innovation. Monocle Films travelled to the 16th arrondissement to sample Le Bon Marché's new addition to La Grande Épicerie family.
Food is a lot of memory. It's memory with your mother, with your grandmother. Food, it's and it's a pleasure. You have to find this game with a product. I try in the architecture to have this sensibility.
For a filmic tour of La Grande Épicerie, Rive Droite, head to monocle.com.
In Paris, 10:19 here in London. You're listening to Sunday Brunch with me, Emma Nelson. Now, Gander & White is a company that you might not have heard of, but you've definitely needed them if you've looked at a picture in an art gallery. They have a reputation for excellence in the handling of shipping of fine arts. And they celebrate their 85th anniversary this year. And the company's business development manager, Alexander Bradford, joined Henry Rees Sheridan to tell him a little more.
So we were obviously founded in 1933 here in London, and back then things were obviously very different to how they are now. The company went through the war. It was set up by Frank White and Walter Gander. And during the war, Frank was in the RAF and Mr. Gander carried on running the business. And then at the end of the war, Frank came back to London and they set about growing the business. Mr. Gander died. And so Frank took over. He died in 1966 and his wife took over the business and bought out Mrs. Gander. So it's now completely in the White family.
Now, obviously, shipping is an absolutely critical part of the international art industry.
Yeah.
But it's also the least visible, which lends it a little bit of an enigmatic air. Describe to me, how does your company fit into the art ecosystem?
Okay, well, first of all, I'd say if we are being invisible, then we're doing our job right. I like to think of us a bit like boutique shipping. I would say we are very much behind the scenes. We're bespoke, but you've also got to remember it's not just about the shipping side of things. It's also about the installation, the project management side of things, getting things through customs and all that sort of other side of things that people might not think about.
So to get into a little bit more detail, what are some of the day-to-day logistical challenges that you face that people outside of the industry might not be aware of?
A collector could buy a very heavy bronze statue or a marble statue. They may live in an apartment in Manhattan, and they might not think about the fact that due to the weight of this piece, it might not go in through their lift. So you might have to think about getting a crane involved to lift it up, to put it through into the house. You've also got issues with delays with customs, applying for CITES licenses, which is when things have ivory or tortoise shell. And then, of course, out of the UK, especially, well, Europe, everything over a certain value needs export licenses if it's over 50 years old. And that's something that someone who's not a regular collector might not think about.
How have broader shifts in the art world, and I'm talking about in terms of what kinds of arts are being produced, who's buying, who's collecting, where they are in the world, really thinking about it holistically.
Yep.
How have those shifts affected the way you operate and how has your company kind of adapted to those changes?
I would say that in the earlier days, we were very much focused on antiques in the 30s, antiques, brown furniture, as a lot of people call it. And the market has very much evolved. That's now a much smaller part of the art market. There's a lot of contemporary pieces, which are usually a lot more complicated to ship. We have become a lot more involved in the interior design world as things have changed. 30 years ago, interior design was a much less prevalent part of the market. But as you've had more people becoming more affluent, people have taken on interior design services. And so that's become a very big part of what we do.
I'm also interested, and I'm not sure, I might be putting you on the spot here slightly, but the company has found itself working at some interesting and critical historical junctures. Can you tell me a little bit about some of those historical figures that you've worked with?
Yeah, I can tell you a few. Some I can't tell you about. One of the job I was thinking about recently that was really interesting, because I've just come back from our San Francisco office, was that in the 30s, we, for our first big international shipment, we shipped out all the wood panels for Hearst Castle in California. That was in conjunction with a company called Aspreys, which is still going in London. In the 50s, we had a big project going on for the King Faisal of Iraq, and everything was in store in our warehouse at the time he was assassinated. That was rather dramatic. That was, again, a project that was going on with Aspreys, actually. Then we've been involved with things such as shipping the ashes when they've gone out of Lourdes, which is very unusual.
The cricket trophy, we should say, for our international listeners.
Sorry. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I presume that you're engaged in equally historically interesting projects as we speak, but of course you can't talk about them. So, yeah, I'll just leave that out there for listeners to speculate about. My final question is that, from a logistical perspective, what new challenges or major industry shifts do you see on the horizon in the near future?
Obviously, Brexit is massively in the news at the moment. For us, that does pose challenges, potentially also potentially opportunities, with the potential of, if we have a no deal and crash out of the customs union and the single market with nothing in place, then there could be problems of huge delays at customs. We're lucky that we are able to customs clear items in our own warehouse. But if every EU-bound shipment, outbound and inbound, is going to have customs clearance done, that's going to cause a lot of extra logistics. We're going to need extra manpower, but in our offices, things will take a lot longer. And obviously, our clients expect things to be done very quickly. We are lucky because we have an office in Paris as well. So we're placed for that, which is great.
Alexander Bradford there, talking to Henry Rees Sheridan. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Time for our weekend read. Anita Kelsey is a cat behaviourist and groomer. Meanwhile, Alan S. Cowell is a former foreign affairs journalist for the New York Times, very different in title, but united by a great understanding of cats, explored through literature. Well, both of them spoke to Georgina Godwin, and Georgina began by asking Anita what a cat behaviourist is.
It's basically a person who's studied feline behaviour, and they deal with issues. If clients are having issues, then they visit the home and try and sort out the issues and the relationship between cat and human.
How do you get to the root of what might be bothering a cat? How do you see into a cat's head?
It's really just looking into their environment and just seeing how they're acting within their environment. Because basically, before I do a cat behaviour consultation, the client is sent at least about 11 page worth of a form to fill out, where they have to give me the whole history of the cat, and then I visit the home and see what the problem is. And probably I'd say 9 times out of 10 it's just owners doing something wrong or the environment's not right for the cat.
Well, Alan, in your book, of course, what happens is that a cat gets inside a human's head.
Well, it's kind of both ways. I'm not quite sure what exactly happens. I think it's probably better that it stays that way. It's a bit of a mystery. But the idea came to me from sitting at my computer, and the cat would always join me. And I began to think, well, I can know what I see when I look at you, but what are you seeing about me? And it just made me think about exploring the world from a cat's point of view, just from the very basics. Look how small they are. They're looking up. Everything must look like, you know, the Empire State Building to them. And we're clumping around with our huge feet, and they can jump enormous heights, and they can do things that humans just can't.
Absolutely. And, of course, from your perspective, Anita,
I think many people might have an idea that cat groomers have quite a relaxed and pristine job. But in your book, we're seeing it can be quite dangerous, actually.
Yeah, well, obviously, I've written about my worst cases. Many, many cats don't like being groomed. They don't like the entrapment of being held in one place. They don't like being told what to do. And a lot of people just haven't got the right tools to begin with. So they've already got a bit of an aversion to grooming. So it's not the easiest job in the world, and it can be quite dangerous as well.
I can imagine. Do you feel, Alan, that you had any kind of special insight into your cats? You, for instance, your cat, does it have any problems?
The cat that inspired me on my computer, I don't think had any particular or has any particular problems. I think the cat in the book, which is called X, that's the name she has, she's a more complicated person, and because she's got this human voice inside her head telling her to do things that cats can't do. You know, the opposable thumb is something that we humans love to take advantage of. They can't do that. She can't tap on a computer screen or turn a page or a lot of the things that we take for granted as humans. So I guess that was the closest thing she would have to a problem, is just not being human.
Anita, do different cats have different needs then?
Absolutely. Every personality of a cat is different. So I know that some breeders, for example, some breeders will say this particular cat is just bred to be an indoor cat. But to me, there's no such thing as an indoor cat. It's very much about their personalities and very unique personalities.
And of course, in your book, you describe X as very much as an indoor cat.
Yes, an indoor cat, and I think that has its advantages and disadvantages. I mean, I know several indoor cats, and they have problems, you know, with diet. They can put on weight very easily. You've got to keep them amused and exercised. You know, it is a challenge. And of course, the book itself isn't just about the cats. It's about the humans the cat's keeping an eye on behalf of the reader, I hope.
Yes.
And so I wanted it to be a book about humans seen through a cat's eyes.
And of course, if a cat has problems, it probably is the human's fault, isn't it, Anita?
Well, I hate to say, because most people have got very, very good intentions, but they just need to kind of tweak a few things, really. And so I think when we change our perspective, then you can change the cat. Mm. Yeah, so that's why I'm really interested in reading your book very much, because it's perfect that you've written a book seeing life through the cat's eyes, which is what I always try and tell the humans that I work with to do. So amazing.
What do you think life looks like through a cat's eyes?
Oh dear. I think that they're just very independent. I think that they can get very bored. I mean, every cat is different. It's hard for me to describe, but I think that particular cats have particular needs, and I just need to see their environment first to understand exactly what's going on before I can comment on that. But
yeah.
I think we just don't take into account just how bored they sometimes get and how much stimulation they need, especially for indoor cats.
Yeah. Well, Alan, of course, in your book, the X in your book gets rather a lot of stimulation, that seeing a lot of things that perhaps shouldn't be going on.
Well, that was a very difficult part to write, because one doesn't want to write too much that could be construed as even mildly pornographic. But on the other hand, there was an element to the plot line that required a degree of veracity in its depiction of the events. And I also wanted to try and make the book a bit funnier than some of my other books have been. So I thought the idea of this sort of voyeuristic cat was quite amusing for one chapter, and hoped it won't offend anybody if and when they read it.
Well, now, you're talking about your other work because, of course, you are a renowned journalist for all sorts of outlets, but notably the New York Times, and this is certainly not your first book, but it is a departure from the rest of your work.
I hope people will believe me when I say this, that it is the least autobiographical book I've ever written, because if anybody thinks I have first-hand experience of some of the things that happen in this book, I think I'll be sunk. I mean, it's a work of pure fiction.
Given that a lot of it concerns adultery and the fact that I know and love your wife, I'm quite sure it's not true. Anita, you too have a hinterland, a really exciting backstory in that you've been a backing singer for people like the Spice Girls.
Yes, I was a singer-songwriter for 30 years before I changed career. I had a total change.
Why? How?
Oh, it's a bit of a sad story, but I basically had a bit of a personal tragedy. And so I have a recording studio, and I couldn't face going into the studio to write or sing for at least about 2 years. And so during that time, I just decided that my next passion was cats. And so I'm just going to really just have a total change in life and just go for working with cats. It was just as, yeah, as simple as that.
So, can I ask you if the Spice Girls, or indeed Razor Light and Boy George, who you've also worked with, mm-hmm. have cats? And if so, if they have a good relationship with them?
Do you know what? I don't know them personally because I was just brought in to do backing vocals. And so I didn't get to actually meet those people personally, because when you go into the studio, you don't exactly meet them. You're just brought in on other days to meet them. So I couldn't comment on that, I'm afraid.
Right. But you have met many, many cats across London. And yes. in fact, that's really what your book is about. It's about yes. what
Thousands.
Happens to you when you meet these cats. What are some of your best stories?
So when cats play up with me, to kind of lighten the tension between the owner and myself, I've started to send them Asbos. So I've found these fake Asbos online, and I send the Asbo through the post, and it just makes the client laugh, because we don't always get compliant cats, and sometimes we just have to deal with a very incompliant cat for the rest of their lives. So my worst cat is Star, and she features in the book, and she got an Asbo. Yeah. And her behaviour still hasn't improved.
How do you know when a cat is cured, if one can ever be cured?
Well, I work holistically with cats, so I use food and treats, and very much is involved is just training the owner how to comb the cat in between my visits. So I educate them on the right tools, the right handling techniques, and just working at small sections at a time. And some cats we've managed to turn around, and other cats, because of their history, we've never managed to turn around. And obviously the worst ones have to be done under sedation.
Very difficult stuff. Yeah. But still, we can read all about it. And lots of stories of hope in there.
I mean, absolutely. There is hope. If you work holistically with a cat and understand how the cat is viewing the groom, there's definitely hope.
Well, your book is called Claws, Confessions of a Professional Cat Groomer, and that came out in September last
yes.
year. Now, Alan, does yours have a happy ending?
I think you could call it a redemptive ending. It's certainly a happy ending for the cat. I think it is a generally happy ending in the sense that those who have sinned the most are punished the most, and those who haven't have a new life.
Alan S. Cowell and Anita Kelsey talking to Georgina Godwin. To hear more from Georgina, check out Meet the Writers. You can hear the full back catalogue online at monocle.com. Up next, we go through the weekend papers.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1600 London time. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
It's 10:35 here in London, 11:35 if you're waking up in Monaco. Let's go through the newspapers with the journalist Marie Bion, the journalist for French media. Welcome back to Studio One, Marie. Lovely to
Hello.
See you. Okay, we have a Brexit ban on the news, and quite right too. It has exhausted us all. So let's start with The Observer, the Zimbabwean elections.
Yes, so yes, tomorrow the country basically votes for a new president. That's the first election after the 37-year rule of Robert Mugabe. He was ousted by a military coup 9 months ago, and he was succeeded at the helm of the country and the party, the ZANU-PF, by Emmerson Mnangagwa, who used to be his friend, but just before the fall of the president started to basically not get on with him well anymore. So, but he's still basically in his wake in terms of policies and all that. He was, he's a candidate, of course, and he was involved in many of the atrocities and violence that happened during the last 30 years, basically, of Robert Mugabe. So he's one of the candidates. He's the one basically ahead on the polls at the moment. There's another, of course, candidate, and he's 3 points behind Mnangagwa, so it's not far behind. And he's Nelson Chamisa. He's from the MDC, so the Democratic Movement for Democratic Change Party, and he's the main opposition guy. He's 40-year-old, and he's a lay preacher. And he's basically the one that could really shake the politics of the party now after 40 years of rule. He could be the one who oust, we're the first, basically the first one to oust a liberation party in the region, because of course NUPF has been in power for 47 years, meaning that basically Mugabe was in power for 37 years, but the party has always been there since basically Zimbabwe is not a British colony anymore. So there will be a big, big change if, of course, Chamisa win. There's a lot of hurdles, of course, for him to be elected.
There are so many new things here in this nation. The fact that this is the first time that Mugabe hasn't been on the voting ticket.
Indeed.
Which is an astonishing thing. And one of the criticisms that comes out in this excellent article in The Observer is the fact that we don't need a big man anymore. We need a big idea. But how do you help Zimbabweans to embrace a different way of political thinking when in the past the political structure has been determined from the top down by a single individual?
That would be a big shake-up of the way people feel and think. But, I mean, at the start of the campaign, it was thought that Chamisa had no chance at all to be elected. But he's a good orator. He's been doing a good campaign, and the ZANU-PF party is being weighed down by the spectre of Mugabe. They're trying. I mean, Mnangagwa is saying that he's a different man, and the party is bigger than one man, and it's different and it's not going to be the same. Mugabe has nothing to do with politics anymore. But still, I mean, the ghost of Mugabe is there. And Chamisa has basically sprung up in the polls in the last month, meaning that the people are perhaps willing to try for a change, because they know that, I mean, the economic situation in Zimbabwe is awful, and it's partly to blame to Mugabe. And what Chamisa is offering is basically a new image to the international community, and that's very important. The article said it very well. And if the election goes well, meaning if there's no violence, if there's no rigging of the polls, and if the victory, if it's a victory of the opposition, is accepted by ZANU-PF, if everything goes smoothly and well, it means that Zimbabwe will have basically bought himself a better reputation in the international community. And that's very important, because they need the international community, Zimbabweans, to have loans, to have basically investment, so that the economy starts up again. And Chamisa is seen as a better man to do that than someone who's basically the heir of a party that is very much frowned upon, more than that, in the international community.
Because I think what's been mentioned in this article and elsewhere is that despite the fact that there was this enormous swelling of goodwill when Mnangagwa took control immediately after the departure of Robert Mugabe, with the great promise that life would change, mm-hmm. this article points out that actually, for everyday Zimbabweans, life is just the same.
I mean, it's only 9 months ago, of course, that Mugabe was ousted, so you can't do much at the time. But it's true that, I mean, the apparatchik of the party remained the same, the working of the party remained the same, some of the people remained the same as well, even Mnangagwa. I mean, he was seen as a new man, but he's a former spy, he's a former ally of Mugabe. So it's not, I mean, it's different, but the change, as seen by the people, is not exactly with the ZANU-PF. It will be a complete shift. And it was thought completely impossible because the country was attached to this party, the Liberation Party. But it seems like they are getting closer to the opposition now. So it's very much up in the air. And tomorrow, what's going to happen is basically the turnout is going to be important. The way the election goes is going to be also extremely, extremely important. And we know that it's the first time that international and local observers are basically numerous. There are something like 1,000 of them. And international press as well have been issued visas, which is quite new as well, meaning that from the country, from the administration, there's will that the election goes well, because ZANU-PF or MDC, they both know that the way the election is conducted is very important for the future stability and economic health of the country.
Let's move on to the Financial Times weekend edition. Let's go and have a look at what Emmanuel Macron is up to. And Macron, the bodyguard and the May Day scandal, he's battling a big political crisis, isn't he? I mean, this is... Yeah. These crises befall every world leader. This one has got particularly interesting claws, hasn't it?
Yes, well, every leader, as you say, has some kind of gate, and every French president had their gate. This one arrives quite early in the presidency and is a bit special. So basically, to sum it up, on May Day, so, you know, the traditional protest day in France, yes, we do have a protest day in France, that's everything every year, and this guy, who was the bodyguard of one of the main bodyguard of personal bodyguard of Emmanuel Macron, decided to basically take the gear of a policeman and not only police the May Day protest, but also attacks at least two protesters. And he beat one guy and one woman. And the Élysée knew about that. They decided to suspend him for 2 weeks, but they didn't inform the judicial system. They didn't basically call on him, basically. They just suspended him. But a few weeks afterwards, a video of him beating up the protesters appeared on the net, and Le Monde published it as well. And it became a very big thing, because not only was a very close friend of the president accused and apparently guilty of very unprofessional behavior and of impersonating a policeman, but the Élysée Palace decided to cover it up for one reason or another. They decided not to talk about that and decided to only suspend him for 2 weeks, whereas the it was seen as the crime, of course, not a crime, but the behavior of Benalla, so the bodyguard, required a bit more than just a slap on the wrist. And because it was just a slap on the wrist, it became an enormous gate for Emmanuel Macron, because he's seen as the president who seems himself above the other, the self-processed Jupiterian president, says the FT. And that means that not only it seems as, you know, away from the public, but he shows himself as being having an entourage, having people around him who are unaccountable to the public, and because the party is quite new, unaccountable to the party as well, not validated by the party. He can basically choose the friends he wants around him, and maybe he's not a good chooser of friends.
Indeed, this is one of those things that is it happens to everybody in power, doesn't it? You surround yourself by people you trust, and this is made aware of in this article by saying that Macron's highly centralised team of trusted millennial male aides, and they say both the strength and weakness of the president is to have a very centralised and vertical organisation around him. It's great when things go well because he can get things done quickly, but when one of those is exposed as being, as this man was, as, you know, dressing up as a policeman and assaulting protesters, it really makes you question about how the rest of the system works, doesn't
Indeed.
It? Yeah. What do you think this is going to do in the long term for Emmanuel Macron and the way that he's actually taken responsibility for it? He's put his hand up and said, actually, at the end of the day, the buck stops with me.
Yes, he said that, but at the same time, he's also basically proved a bit of bravado, saying, let them come and get me. So it's not just saying that, OK, I'm sorry, and it's just me you have to blame. He's also saying, well, you know, no, I can do what I want, but basically you can't reach me. So that's something that's this let them come and get me. It's not something that went well in the press or in the British people. So he's not already not very popular. He's already have 37% of approval in the population because of his reforms. So that's not good. Also, this gate kind of changed the calendar of his reform. I mean, they have to push back to the rentrée, as we call it, to September, some of the reform that was supposed to happen before the summer. So it already basically changed the political agenda. But also, there's a vote of no confidence that was basically asked by the opposition parties. And they are all united, right and left, against the president on that. So there's no chance that the vote of no confidence is going to pass because, of course, Macron has the overwhelming majority in the parliament.
Exactly.
But still,
where is the political opposition to Emmanuel Macron at the moment?
Everywhere around the centre he's supposed to occupy, basically. There's, of course, the centre-right wing, Les Républicains of the former president Nicolas Sarkozy, for example, and they are very much against him and starting to go more and more on the right. There's also the Socialist Party. He was never a socialist party man, although he worked for François Hollande. Of course, François Hollande was the head of the Socialist Party. And there's also the further on the left, there's the La France Insoumise, the French Unbowed, that also are very, very critical of Macron. And basically, the right says that Macron is on the left, and the left says that Macron is on the right. So he's got everyone against him. But still, his electoral win in the presidency and the general election means that he's not too preoccupied about basically his future in terms of his presidency. It's mainly in the opinion that it's going to be a problem. And if that basically gives something, basically a bone to Grinch for the opposition party, something that unite them and make them stronger, that could be a problem. Because at the moment, the opposition parties, they are numerous, but they are very weak. They don't have a, you know, figurehead to help them combat Macron. So anything that can make them stronger is a bit of a problem for Macron. And he himself shoot himself in the foot with that. That's something that's widely acknowledged.
Let's move on to the Sunday Times and to, excuse me, another European government that's being controlled by one rather problematic central figure. We're going to Italy. Salvini looks to babies to save Italy's identity. We're talking about the right-wing Interior Minister Matteo Salvini says the low birth rate is being used as an excuse to import immigrants. Who would have thought this kind of talk would be allowed nowadays?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's Italy today, and that's him in particular, of course. He's a very special man in a way, and he's very controversial, but he's not afraid of his ideas. And basically what he says is that the reason why we have immigration is because we don't do enough babies. And he says, I mean, the Sunday Times says that, quoted him saying, at the end of this mandate, the government will be measured on the number of newborns more than on the public debt. So that's quite a saying, basically. So what he's saying basically is that there's too much immigration, and there's too much immigration because we don't have any enough Italians doing the jobs that immigrants are coming to take. But at the same time, of course, they have the opposite argument, saying that the immigrants steal the jobs of the Italian people. So it's a populist argument, if there's one.
Well, his rhetoric has moved Italy's focal political point to the right, hasn't it? Which is said in this article. He's a dominant force in Italy's politics. And we're now going to a hardline Eurosceptic and anti-immigration position, which appeals to the protectionists and the nationalists in Italy.
Yes, but at the same time, as the articles say, he also created a cheery brand of populism, meaning that he's not, you know, a dour politician just, beating the immigrants up in his speech. He's also someone who's quite personable, and that's his main strength. Of course, he's got, 800,000 followers on Twitter, 3 million on Facebook, and so that means that he's a very popular figure. But he used those social media to basically paint migrants, as the article say, paint migrants as rapists and Roma people as thieves. So he's just like his discourse, the way he's seen in Italy is very, very controversial in a way. And this politicization of fertility is something that's completely new and something that in the context of the country might be something that basically find traction.
And finally, briefly,
yes,
we had opera at the beginning of the programme. You're now telling us that we're supposed to be listening to jazz as well. We're going very cerebral in our musical taste.
Oh, you don't have to choose. You can you can listen to jazz and classical music. And in fact, the article says that it's in an article in the Sunday Telegraph. They're saying that they have something in common, classical and jazz, is that the audience is older and more old, meaning that basically new generation normally don't take up classical music and jazz and don't go to bars to listen to jazz and classical. Well, of course, you don't go to bars to listen to classical music, but you can go to bars to listen to jazz. And what the article is saying is that it's true that, I mean, in the 80s, there were 30% of the under 30 who used to listen to jazz. 11% now of the under 30s listen to jazz. But recently, very recently, so it's not yet a trend, but it's something that's noticeable, the likes of Spotify and this kind of thing basically noticed a 108% increase in jazz downloading music. And he says, the journalist says that it's not just that jazz is being more cool because they are trying to, and they are basically using all the kind of music. I mean, you know, jazz is not one kind of music. It's influenced by and many other musical influences, if I can say. And so that's something good, because they can take something from dance, take something from techno, this kind of thing. That's what he's saying. I don't know about it. But he's also saying that the reason why jazz is more and more popular is that it's starting to get people dancing again. And dancing is the reason why young people like music at the moment. So if you dance with jazz, you can get acquainted with jazz, apparently.
Always at one with a swing beat. That's Marie Billon. Thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Today on Sunday Brunch, there's been an awful lot of coverage in the media for the last couple of years or so about the difficulty of being a woman in most industries. Chances are you'll be paid less, you'll have to work harder to get recognised, and you run the risk of being the female rather than being the talented one. Well, Ulri Altmer is executive chef at Bokan Restaurant, Bar and Terrace in Canary Wharf. She says she feels this frustration with her own work in the kitchen. A very warm welcome to the programme, Ulri. First of all, tell us, before we start talking about gender politics, what kind of food do you like to make in your kitchen?
So we make very simple food with a produce base. So we always try to get the best produce we can and to make them simple to let them shine.
Okay, so give me an example of what you'd be serving today or tomorrow.
Today, for example, we do a braised lamb shoulder from Rogue Estate. So we braise it for 7 hours and we just serve it with a little panis, which is a chickpea flour kind of fries, and apricot, which is nice at the moment.
You sounded just so sort of gently throwaway about that, and my head is now spinning with the concept of just eating something like that for lunch. You're the executive chef at Bokan. Okay, let's talk about what it is like to be a woman in the kitchen. What's it been like in your experience from the beginning upwards?
I never saw myself as a woman in the kitchen. You know, I just saw myself as somebody working in the kitchen, no matter the gender. Never put a stop to me. If somebody did feel different toward me, I never look at it. You know, I just try to be the best at everything I do and I work hard to achieve what I want.
Did you ever find, though, that you'd notice that you'd be working a little bit harder and a little bit longer hours and having to be possibly a little bit more aggressive than you would naturally think you should be?
I don't know if I have to be more aggressive, but I really do feel as a woman, you, in your set of mind, you always try to prove that you can do as much as everybody else. So, yes, I think I do work a bit harder.
You've been listening to that gentleman. Because someone has once said that the definition of no longer needing feminism is when you have an equal number of mediocre women in positions of power as you have mediocre men. Do you sometimes find that in your experience and in the experience of other female chefs that you actually have to be slightly better at your job in order to get further? And if you do, can you give me an example of when that's happened?
I don't know if I have to be better than any men. I just think that I have to be very good at, because you are on the spotlight every single night, you know, when you cook for 100 person, you're trying to do the best you can to make everybody, to please everybody, so you always try to be the best at everything you do.
And do you ever find that you have quite a lot of mediocre men, but the women who always work for you are extremely good?
We don't have many women in the kitchen at the moment.
Why not?
It's hard to find. I don't know. We don't have many. I have at the moment maybe 3 in my team.
And what is it that you think it is that is putting women off from going into the kitchen?
Maybe, you know, the long hour. It's a physical job. You're on your feet for a longer amount of time. I don't know, maybe a bit scared, maybe, I have no idea.
You don't know, you've no idea because you've done it yourself. I mean, do you actively go and try and recruit women into your kitchen then?
No, I'm trying to recruit people who are motivated and no matter.
Now, this has happened while you've been in London. Growing up in France, I mean, whereabouts in France are you from? And what was it like growing up trying to enjoy a love of food in France and then deciding that actually you wanted to make this into a career?
So I was born in Strasbourg and then I moved to Paris when I was very young. So I grew up in Paris. I did my culinary study in Paris. Food was always very important in my family. We always eat very well. My mom and my dad always went to the market on Sunday. So my mom is Italian origin. So, you know, family meal was always a very big part of our family. And then
At some point when I was 14, I didn't know what to do. I was not very good at school. And then I realized then cooking could be a career, which until now it was only being fun, you know, cooking with my family. So I said, why not? And I never regretted that choice.
No, what was it? How did you then go about making sure that you could establish yourself professionally?
So when you start very young, so I start when I was 15 doing my apprenticeships. And then, you know, just the love of what wanted to do the best you could always and trying to do good food. And then, you know, going from one place to the next and always following, you know. I never really looked for a job. I always, you know, somebody said to me, oh, I have a place for you there and there and there. So I just move along. And
that's kind of a dream career. So if you were talking to a sort of a 14-year-old already now, who is a woman, and you're trying to say, look, you are a chef. You're not a woman or a male chef. You are just someone who does your job. What advice would you give her now that you could impart?
Just go for it, you know. Don't look back and don't regret anything, and just try the best you can every single day.
Okay, Aurélie Oltmayer, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. That's all we have time for this edition of Sunday Brunch here in London. Thank you for your company. Thanks too to our producer and studio manager, George McDonough, and our researcher, Pierre-Antoine Denis. Coming up, we have Charlie Crockett on the Midori House Sessions, and then from midday, Fernanda Augusta Pacheco and Tom Edwards bring us hijinks and japes in the Monocle Weekly. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you for listening and have a good week.